Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Bombing and talking. The U.S., Iran, and Israel. Trump's national security team is a mess, and U.S.-Japan defense talks are in trouble. First, bombing and talking. Will talks between the U.S. and Iran and the ceasefire between Iran and Israel last? Will they bring peace? These are the top questions following the stand-down by all three sides on Monday. Iran launched 10 missiles at the U.S. base in Qatar, but warned the U.S. in advance, allowing the base to be cleared. Trump thanked Iran and said on his Truth Social, quote, "Iran has officially responded to our obliteration of their nuclear facilities with a very weak response, which we expected and have very effectively countered. There have been 14 missiles fired," said Trump, "but there were no casualties." Then Trump offered this playground-level assessment, quote, "Most importantly, they've gotten it all out of their system, and there will hopefully be no further hate. Perhaps Iran can now proceed to peace and harmony in the region, and I will enthusiastically encourage Israel to do the same." Later in the day, Trump announced that Israel and Iran had agreed to a ceasefire, now in its second day. How long it will last is anybody's guess. No doubt all sides will claim victory, but surely not a victory for peace. Israel has devastated Iran's military capabilities and leadership in what can only be called an act of aggression. The 10 days of attacks were a political victory for Prime Minister Netanyahu and the fulfillment of long-standing plans to destroy Iran's nuclear facilities. Yet many observers are not convinced that he or Trump completely succeeded or as claimed. Experts point to hundreds of pounds of enriched uranium that remain unaccounted for and may have been moved or previously buried. The nuclear research labs apparently were hit but not completely destroyed. A preliminary U.S. intelligence report from the Defense Intelligence Agency, obtained by the New York Times, says that Iran's nuclear program may only have been set back by a few months. Various U.S. officials are disputing the report, hewing to Trump's line about obliteration. That leaves open the possibility that Iran will still be able to pursue production of nuclear weapons, an aim it had not attempted to achieve until now. Meantime, Iran's political leadership remains intact, despite Netanyahu's clear goal of regime change. Trump's statement urging an end to hate is fatuous. Iran has been subjected to withering bombing. At least 600 civilians have been killed. Thousands of people, probably including many who despise the regime, have assembled to shout death to America. Nationalism remains a strong feature of Iran's politics. So, end of hate? Hardly. As for the U.S.-Iran talks, which Trump says will resume next week, they are on a different level since the U.S. became a belligerent in this war. Will Iran now cave in and agree to end all uranium enrichment? And what if Iran persists in its original position that enriching uranium for energy is a matter of sovereignty? The U.S. would do well to revive the 2015 nuclear deal, which capped enrichment, provided for international inspection, and insured against a nuclear breakout by Iran. Trump's national security team is a mess. In every previous U.S. administration since at least World War II, there was a clearly defined decision-making process. Each president charted a particular model, depending largely on his prior experience and his confidence in his national security advisor and secretary of state. The Trump presidencies have been another story. In his first term, Trump regularly promoted and demoted top foreign policy officials. On their part, the focus was on imposing guardrails around a know-nothing commander-in-chief. It has been apparent since day one of Trump's second term that his national security team has two dysfunctional features. It is largely composed of loyalists and not people with experience and competence, and in its actual functioning, it is Trump and the rest. Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, always a reliable observer, reports that no more than a half dozen people have Trump's ear, with Trump most likely to follow the last of them to have it. Consequently, the outcome is likely to be unpredictable. As Trump demonstrated in the lead-up to bombing Iran, he is capable of changing his mind in an instant, from waiting 2 weeks to acting on impulse. Various reports indicate that the change caught the military and others by surprise, and not happily, since Trump was telegraphing U.S. actions. Those same officials were also surprised when Trump announced a ceasefire before Iran and Israel had actually agreed to one. And the claims of monumental destruction of Iran's nuclear sites and the plea to oil companies not to raise prices, and the insistence that if Iran's a regime can't make Iran great again, it should be changed. Hard to know what to make of such careless utterances. Now we're seeing the results of this chaos. Most prominent among the unfit is Pete Hegseth, he of the Signal Group episode. Hegseth recently took heavy fire from Democratic senators when he testified about deployment of soldiers to U.S. cities. He simply refused to give a reason why that deployment was either necessary or effective. In the Middle East war, Hegseth has reportedly ceded key decision-making responsibility to his central command general, sidelining other Pentagon military officials and perhaps being sidelined himself. Then there's Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, whose affection for the now-departed Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad nearly derailed her nomination. She reportedly made the mistake, as Trump sees it, of citing intelligence findings that Iran is not close to having a nuclear bomb. "I don't care what she said," Trump said. Forget about the intelligence, in other words, since that finding contradicted his justification for war. Trump has reportedly sidelined Gabbard on Middle East affairs. Trump's team is a team of one. All he has to rely on are two billionaires, Howard Lutnick, the Secretary of Commerce, and Steve Witkoff, his chief negotiator with everyone, and a hawkish Secretary of State who was also his national security advisor. A very bad way to run an effective bureaucracy, assuming you value a diversity of opinion. One evidence that diversity of opinion is not welcome is the reported dissolution of an interagency working group under the National Security Council that was devoted to finding ways to push Russia to the bargaining table with Ukraine. According to Graham Slattery at Reuters, the working group found diminishing interest by Trump in pressing Russia, making the group's work useless. Then came the purging of the National Security Council, including dismissal of its Russia and Ukraine specialists. The fascinating flip side to this story appeared in a Telegraph article. It offers an explanation for what lay behind the disbandment of the National Security Council Working Group on Russia. A senior official in the U.S. State Department named Darren Beatty, who was appointed by Trump in early February, is a Kremlin stooge married to the daughter of a wealthy Russian businessman with close ties to Putin. Beatty, who has repeatedly expressed admiration for Putin, was instrumental in shutting down State Department and NSC programs designed to counter Kremlin propaganda. The Telegraph article notes, quote, "In the years before joining the government, Mr. Beatty wrote social media posts suggesting Western institutions should be, quote, infiltrated by Putin, while he also attacked what he described as the globalist American empire." Beatty may also qualify as a racist, says the Telegraph. Quote, "Mr. Beatty was a member of the first Trump administration, but after being sacked in 2018 for allegedly attending a white nationalist conference, he reinvented himself as an alt-right media figure." My third top story, U.S.-Japan defense talks are in trouble. In recent years, Japan has complied with long-standing U.S. wishes that it increase military spending. But apparently there is a limit to how big an increase Japan is willing to accept. Last week, Tokyo abruptly scrapped annual 2+2 security talks involving the allies' top diplomats and defense chiefs less than 2 weeks before the meeting, after the U.S. asked Japan to hike its defense budget to 5% of gross domestic product. That is far more than Japan's planners have in mind, which is 2% of GDP by 2027. A Pentagon spokesman says that the Trump administration has set a global standard for U.S. allies of 5% of GDP on the military. At the NATO meetings this week in The Hague, all members except Spain agreed to the 5% standard. Trump threatened Spain, saying it will have to, quote, pay twice as much in tariffs. For Japan, however, that figure would be politically risky, given its history, its economic situation, and most recently Trump's tariffs on autos and steel. So far, Japan has resisted the Trump administration's pressure to sign on to a new trade deal. In other news, North Korea is experiencing near-famine conditions, yet is sending more soldiers to fight in Ukraine. North Korea has experienced severe food shortages for the last 30 years, including famine in the 1990s that killed up to 3 million people. Now a report by the Bush School at Texas A&M University, in cooperation with the NGO Human Rights in North Korea, concludes that North Korea is experiencing a food emergency due to severe food shortages, reported widespread adoption of crisis coping strategies, and mass starvation-related deaths in 2021, continuing into 2022-23. The report finds that at least 20% of households in North Korea are experiencing severe food shortages. Acute malnutrition levels are expected to be between 15 to 30%, and between 1 to 2 people every day out of 10,000 are dying. The report also notes that the public distribution system for food has failed, leading the government to severely restrict access to food and food distribution. In the midst of this crisis, the Russian news agency is reporting that North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will send 1,000 combat engineers and 5,000 military builders to help restore the Kursk region in Russian-occupied Ukraine. The announcement came after Sergei Shoigu, Secretary of the Security Council of Russia, visited North Korea. According to Shoigu, Moscow and Pyongyang also plan to create memorials for the Korean soldiers who died while liberating the Kursk region. There are around 11,000 North Korean soldiers serving in the Ukraine war. Next, a leaked phone call imperils Thailand's leader. In a phone call between Thailand's young prime minister and Cambodia's former leader, Petongtan Sinawatra seemed to belittle her country's military and cozy up to the Cambodian strongman Hun Sen. The conversation happened in the midst of a border dispute. The Thai prime minister's remarks suggested that Thailand would do anything necessary to placate Cambodia. Now calls are widespread in Thailand for the prime minister to resign, though she maintains that what she was doing was political theater, not negotiations. The leaked conversation could not have occurred at a worse time for Thailand, as it faces serious economic problems and Trump's tariff hikes. When a framework isn't a deal. On June 11 in London, Chinese and U.S. negotiators supposedly worked out a trade deal that would open the way for U.S. companies to obtain rare earth magnets, and the Chinese would again have access to U.S. high-tech exports. But 2 weeks in, there's no sign that the deal is being implemented. Bloomberg reports that, quote, while there has been a trickle of required permits, many American firms that need Chinese rare earth minerals are still waiting on Beijing's approval for shipments, according to people familiar with the process. China's system is improving but remains cumbersome, contrary to Trump's assurances that rare earths would flow up front. The Bloomberg report goes on to say that there is, quote, lingering confusion about what level of magnet approvals from China would trigger Trump to abandon his tit-for-tat export curbs. Even if export approvals accelerate, there are so many unknowns about the licensing regime that it's impossible for companies to have a strong sense of certainty about future supply, said one research director. At a minimum, they need to factor in a real possibility that talks could break down again and exports will be halted. Actually, both sides appear to be holding out, using their leverage with each other. China's rare earth minerals, U.S. technology exports, to wait out the other side. And China surely notices that on the U.S. side, withholding advanced tech exports is still in effect. The Trump administration announced last week that U.S. equipment cannot be supplied to Korean chipmakers' factories in China, according to the Wall Street Journal. Jeffrey Kessler, Undersecretary of Commerce for Industry and Security at the U.S. Commerce Department, notified Samsung Electronics and SK Hynix this week that he is revoking measures that waived their requirement to file applications whenever they supplied U.S.-made equipment to their China-based factories. Finally, a related story, forced labor in China's critical minerals production. Global Rights Alliance, an NGO based in The Hague, Netherlands, reports that China, using forced labor, quote, has now invested significant resources to expand critical mineral exploration, mining, processing, and manufacturing in Xinjiang. The region's rich mineral reserves and geographic proximity to China's trading partners have established it as a national extractive hub. The report focuses on lithium, titanium, and two other minerals that are in global demand and are being intensively mined and processed in Xinjiang for export. The finding of labor abuse poses a major problem for foreign companies that depend on these minerals in advanced technology and clean energy. It remains to be seen how many of these companies will be willing to seek alternative sources of the minerals on finding that forced labor gave them access to the minerals. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.